You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey everyone, Chris Lopez here, and welcome back to another podcast episode. So in the studio today, I've got a special guest, Eric Young, who is the owner and operator of the Denver Property Flip. And so I asked Eric to come in today because he's got a really unique business model, everything from sourcing off-market deals to acquiring them, and then some really neat options that work out that give the homeowners different options on how to sell their property quickly or maximize their equity. And it's also a very good business model for Eric as well. So Eric, thank you, man, for joining me.
No, thanks for having me on. This is awesome.
Yeah, so let's just kind of jump into it because you've got so far, I've never seen any other business model like this, what you're doing at Denver Property Flip. Give us the 60-second rundown on what you do, because it's cool.
Yeah, so Denver is a really competitive market, and I had to get creative on how I could close more leads. And in doing that, I figured out what I call a fix and list to deal.
So that's fix and list, right?
Yes. Yeah. Fix and list. And it's where we offer to put our money into other people's properties and fix them up and then sell them at the top of the market so that the homeowner can keep all the extra equity from pretty much we flip the house and they keep the extra equity from the house flip.
Good. So a couple things to know about Eric is that he is a real estate agent. He's also a general contractor. So he's one of the few guys that can wear both of those hats and do it successfully. Because typically, a lot of times, you know, you're doing your own marketing to generate these motivated sellers or these deals. And typically, a lot of times, you know, investors come in and offer a cash price and a quick close, which, hey, it's all pros and cons. The pro is you get cash, it closes quick. The owner has to do nothing to the property. Downside is a lot of times they are leaving some equity on the table when it comes to the motivated seller. So obviously when it comes to the homeowners, kind of depends on which side of the fence you're on. Good for the investor, you know, sometimes good for the seller too, all pros and cons. So I know you come in and you present different options. What do you tell these homeowners? And like, what are different options, different solutions you offer?
So we offer three different ways that we work with our clients. And so we'll do our homework before we show up. And I say we because at this point, there's three of us. It's not just me. But we'll show up and go through, here's how much money you get if we buy the house for cash. We can close in 5 days or a month, whenever you want to close. So just like all the other investors out there, we throw that offer out. Then we'll go through and analyze what they'd get if they pay us, if they hire us to list their property like a traditional real estate agent.
But that would be listing just as is.
Just listing as is.
Just normal. Do some basic cleanup, but not fixing your renovations, right?
No fixing, no renovations, just exactly how the house is. Like every other agent out there could potentially offer. And then the third option that we'll lay out is if we put in X amount of dollars, then we'll get X amount on the back end and you'll net, you know, X, which typically this isn't always the case, but in most cases, that gives the homeowner the most amount of money. They can walk away with the maximum profit in a fix and list. It also takes the longest and is the biggest pain in the ass for them because they have to deal with their house getting renovated and go on the market and showings. So depending on that seller's threshold for, do they care more about getting the most money? Or do they care more about fast and convenient? And we kind of lay out the gamut of what we can do.
I think that model is brilliant. Got a lot of moving parts here, but it's brilliant. So essentially, when you do that option three there with the fix and list, I mean, I'm assuming like you're essentially flipping the house, but almost partnering with the homeowner so you guys can both share in the profits, right?
That's not how we have it set up.
Okay.
So the homeowner actually keeps all of the extra profits from the flip. Instead, what we do is I contract with the homeowner as their contractor, just like a normal contractor would. I give them the scope of work and the price, and we sign a construction services agreement. And that dollar amount includes my profit for the deal. So it's baked into the construction rehab number.
Okay.
So they already know right up front, if it sells for X amount, they're going to walk away with exactly this much money. It's not a profit split.
Can you walk us through, without giving away addresses or personal details, just kind of like a recent deal that's a good sample for the type of property, the price points? Like, let's say I'm that homeowner and you come to me, lay out the three options, just with some rough numbers, because I'm really curious to hear what they are.
Yeah, so there was a deal we did in Littleton that closed a couple weeks ago, where we sold the property for $440,000. And that we put $55,000 into the property, or that was the construction, the cost to the homeowner for the renovation. And they owed, if I remember right on that one, they owed $340,000 to the lender. And they were thinking they were going to give the house away and walk away even. Just selling it as is, it was about right there. But by putting the $55,000 into the property, they got a check at closing for $45,000 on that deal. And that $45,000 we generated by the extra equity from the $55,000 that we put into the property.
Wow. Okay, so now let's back up even a couple more steps, because you said they owed about $340,000. They're expecting about break even. So I'm assuming if they listed as is, what, $360,000 mark or so?
Somewhere right there.
Okay. Yep. So when you came in, and let's just say I'm that homeowner, when you came in and presented the options, or one of your team members did, I mean, kind of what do you say for option one, option two, option three? Like, kind of what are the rough numbers with those, like as you're explaining them to me, the homeowner?
All right. So that one, I think we offered $320,000 for our cash price.
Okay.
So they could just walk away done.
And that would be, I get cash and it's closing within the week.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Leave any trash behind. Just do nothing. Walk away. You get $340,000 cash. And then we said we could sell it as is, and they were going to get somewhere around 10 to 15 more than that. It's been a while since I was in that person's house, so like these numbers are maybe off a little bit.
No, this guy just wanted the ballpark, about three, this is perfect.
I think they were going to walk away with around 350 if we listed and sold the house.
So not much difference at the end of the day for cash in pocket if they listed as is versus just doing a quick, easy cash sale.
Yeah, because this house was really outdated. It was a woman that lived there her whole life and had passed away, and her daughter, actually, that's not quite true with this one. She hadn't passed away. She moved into assisted living, and her daughter had power of attorney. The owner had Alzheimer's, and they were just trying to liquidate the house and get some money to pay for the facility that the mom was living in.
Okay.
So it was in rough condition. So the as-is price and the on the selling it on the market versus the cash price, we're not that far off.
Okay. And then the option three is what you said were, hey, our scope of work, you said about $50,000 you expected?
It was 55, I think, is what we landed on.
Okay.
As our renovation cost to them. The actual labor and material was right around 45.
Okay. So, and then they obviously went with the fix and list model. And I'm assuming that since they got a check at closing, they were probably happy that they went with that model, went with you, right?
Yeah.
And so, obviously, it sounds like the house was vacant, right? Since the owner was in the long-term care facility and was managed by the estate. So, obviously, that must make it much easier to do the fixed list option because they're not living through the renovation.
Right.
So, is it common, like, if you're doing an owner-oc, motivated seller, is that... do they often live through the renovation, or are they staying with their friends and family for that month or two? How does that work?
So it hasn't happened very many times. It's rare that we end up doing a fix and list where they live in the house.
Okay.
But if it's just carpet, paint, like basic, and if I get a feel from that homeowner that they're really level-headed, they're grounded, like they're going to be able to live in the house while we work on it, because a lot of people... you can't do the renovation while they live in the house, even if it's just carpet and paint, because their threshold for dealing with living in a construction zone is just not there.
Well, it's not fun having drywall dust with your Cheerios in the morning. Like,
no,
I've been there. I know how it is.
Yeah. So I'll feel out the person too. I won't even, some people, based on the vibe I'm getting from them, that option's not there. It's you must move out if we're going to do a fixed list.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense. So just real roughly, I'm curious, so out of those three options, just, hey, we buy cash, sell it as is or list it as is or do a fix and list, what's the rough percentages that fall within options 1, 2, and 3?
Well, these percentages are going to be the way they are because I'm marketing only to motivated house sellers. So if you looked at my website and all my marketing material, I look just like any We Buy Houses kind of company. So I'm bringing in clientele that is more likely to want to sell their house fast for cash because that's what I'm fishing for in my marketing. But about half of the deals that we do end up being cash deals.
Okay.
And I'd say about 40% end up being the fix and list. And about 10% end up being a listing, an as-is listing.
Interesting. Okay. Now, we'll definitely talk more about marketing with Eric a little bit later in the show because he and I sat down a couple weeks ago and then we spent like, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours, way longer than I think either of us expected on talking about things, but just we had to, just lots of stuff to geek out about on marketing and some similar stuff in our background, so it was fun. So before we jump into marketing, I want to kind of just backtrack a little bit about how you got into real estate investing because, I mean, your marketing, your website is dialed in. Like, I really like what you're doing. I respect what you're doing. It's good. Your business process is dialed in. And I mean, would it take you like 2 weeks to do all that? Like, what was what's the journey you got there? Because people always see the end result, but they don't realize, hey, great, like everyone else, you've taken your black eyes along the way. So I'd like to kind of just backtrack to share that story.
All right. So I'm going to backtrack all the way back to high school quick, where when I was in high school, my dad quit his day job and started a sod farming business. And this was back in Sioux City, Iowa. And I watched my dad go from hardly ever around, working all the time, because he was also, he bought farms, kind of like real estate investors here will buy rental properties. My dad would buy farm ground and use that as a semi-passive stream of income. But he was never around, unhappy. He quit his job, started this sod farming business. This was when I was probably like a junior in high school. And I watched our standard of living go way up. My dad go from hardly ever being around to around more, being happy. And I just saw that, thought, oh, that I'm definitely going to start my own business. That is the way. That is what I need to do. So I even all the way back in high school, I quit my job at an electronics store and I started a house painting business. And I hired my best friend's little brother's friends to paint houses with me. And that was my summer job. It worked great. My income doubled. I was happier. It was just a great situation. So taking that into, and from there, I go to college, get a degree, graduate, go into the normal
what was your degree
workforce, civil engineering.
Okay. So you're an engineer.
Yeah. And I had my first job for Hyder Construction as a project engineer doing commercial construction and worked 60 to 80 hours a week. It was just a grind. And it wasn't so much the work hours. It was that I was giving everything I had to build somebody else's business. And the whole time I felt like, man, why did I do all this? You know, I had my own painting business back in high school. And then I went to college to get a degree so I could become a slave to build someone else's business, and was just miserable in that day-to-day process. But in the same time all this happens, I meet my wife. We have a kid. I changed jobs to Pinkard Construction, which was much more doable. Got down to a 50-hour work week instead of a 60 to 80-hour work week. But with having the new kid, it was just a lot of, anyone that's had a new kid knows it sucks up a lot of your time.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to run a side job and your regular job and having a kid is newborn is almost impossible. But I kind of had to figure something out. I got forced, on top of not wanting to work for somebody and always wanting to have my own business, I also was in a situation where I was upside down in my house because we bought right before the last financial crash.
And this was here in Denver.
This is here in Denver.
Okay.
I have a kid. I don't want to send him to the public school system where in the house we were at because it sucked. So I had to come up with money for that. And my wife completely hated her job. I wanted her to be able to quit. So I started flipping houses on the side back then. And I always viewed it more like, oh, I just got to finish this project to get this chunk of change to get me through the next X amount of months. And for some reason, I didn't view that as a viable business plan. And I don't know why that is, but I didn't. I viewed each project as I just got to grind through this one and that'll get me money to get to cover the bills for the next X amount of time. So while doing that,
So this was you started flipping houses before the market crashed or after it crashed? Or did you ride the market down and
right after the crash.
Okay.
It's still headed down. Like in the market had crashed but wasn't finished crashing.
Okay. So
you bought my first property.
The prices were still dropping as you were flipping.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Which didn't last long because the crash was pretty quick. All right, so I was doing all that. On the side, I was also learning how to market because I was trying to grow a multi-level marketing business on the side. And I felt like that's where I would be able to create the income I needed to have my own business. And all that ended up happening is I would make all my money flipping houses and use some of it to fund the deficits from all my other little side businesses that I would try to start that would never work. But I learned a lot about marketing in that process and how to run ads. And a lot of what I took from all those failures, so those other businesses, I'm using now today to generate motivated seller leads in my real estate business.
Okay.
So I'd say it took 8 years of trial and failure in marketing for multiple different business ideas.
So when did it click for you that geez, I should just focus on flipping and real estate because it bringing in cash?
It was about five years ago, maybe 6 years ago, somewhere in there.
Okay.
It clicked that, wait a minute, this is stupid that I'm viewing it this way. Like it finally clicked that there's been so many flips now that all worked that these aren't one-off deals. It wasn't like, oh man, I hit the jackpot. I found this house. I can keep doing this. I've done it enough that it's not a one-off thing.
So right around that time, when things clicked for you mentally, I mean, how many flips had you completed approximately at that time?
4.
Okay. So you had a good sample size, and assuming were they all profitable flips?
Every one of them was profitable.
Nice.
Okay. I never got burned, but I also had the benefit of my day job. By that point, I was a superintendent running big commercial projects. So I was around construction all day, every day. I really knew what things cost and a lot about construction. So I was less prone to get burned on my rehab budget than the average person.
And when did you become a GC or get your GC license? Because I'm assuming that was somewhere along this journey.
Yeah. Yeah, that worked out really good. So Pinkard Construction wanted their superintendents to get their supervisor certificate so that they had multiple options of different supervisors that they could hang underneath Pinkard Construction to pull permits in different jurisdictions.
Okay.
And so they paid for me to get my supervisor certificate with Denver. And Denver's the hardest city to get. After you have your Denver supervisor certificate and then your Denver license, you can use that to get all the other surrounding cities.
What is a supervisor certificate? I don't know what that is.
All right. So the way Denver works is you pass these tests on the IBC or IRC, depending on which certificate you're trying to get. Because I was in commercial construction, mine was on the IRC and the IBC, International Building Code and International Residential Code. So you have to memorize a bunch of sections of the code and pass this big test.
Okay.
So you pass the test, they give you your certificate license or your supervisor certificate. Then you take that supervisor certificate and use it to get your contractor's license.
Okay.
It's set up that way so you could be a business owner and not know anything about construction and hire somebody who passes the test and has the supervisor certificate and then get you can own the license because of the employee that you have that has the certificate.
So you're saying if I hired you and you had your supervisor certificate, I could then become a GC because you were working for Chris Lopez Construction Inc.
Exactly.
Okay.
You could be a licensed contractor if you just had one employee.
Interesting. Okay.
The certificate.
So you then leverage the certificate into just getting your GC license? Is that something you did on your own or is that part of your job? They did that?
Well, that costs about $150 and 5 minutes at a counter to switch your certificate over to having your own. So the hard part's the certificate. The really easy part is getting your license afterwards.
Okay. So you got that. How many years ago is that approximately? Just to kind of piece together time. Because about 5 years ago,
about the same time I figured out I could start flipping, about 5 years ago.
Okay. And then, so I'm trying to paint a mental picture for myself first. So you correct me if I'm painting this wrong, but you've got one kid, maybe a second kid by then, right?
Yeah. What do you? I have two kids at that point.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you got your job, you got tons of balls you're juggling. You say, hey, I'm going to stop juggling these side businesses because I'm going to focus on real estate.
Yep.
And you're probably starting to think about, great, what would it take for me to go full time? And I just got to imagine, like, I've done similar transitions in the past, but I had no wife and no kids then. And I know when I had my first child about 2 years ago, like my risk tolerance went from like, I don't care about anything to like, holy smokes, I'm way more conservative. So I'm putting myself in your shoes or just thinking about that myself. And that makes me nervous. So like, I imagine you're probably like similar minds. Like, hey, great, I want to take care of my family. I want to pursue this. I want to do this. Like, what were you thinking emotionally? And then what type of numbers did you have to have, you know, just roughly to make you feel comfortable to pull that trigger?
Yeah, so I was, and still today, am very risk adverse. And it's probably because of the kids. Yeah. Know, I've got three kids and a wife that I have to support. And so very risk adverse. And but at the same time, I had made a commitment to myself years and years prior that I would become a business owner. So I kind of was in a spot where I didn't really know how I could possibly flip houses full time. Like, where am I going to get all the money to do that? How can I absorb the risk if the market crashes? Because it was coming up and I had just lived through a crash. So I knew that that was always a possibility on the table. And it scared me enough that it was a big deal. But I also couldn't give up on the idea of doing it. So I didn't really know how I would pull it off. I just knew that I needed to. Like, there was no way I was not going to quit my job and flip houses full time. And I also had no idea how I could pull it off. And it sucked. It turned into a grind, really. I just wouldn't give up on trying to make it work, even though I didn't know how I would make it work.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of years of I'm generating leads. I'm calling them back at lunch because I can't pick up the phone while I'm doing my day job. I'm trying to meet motivated seller leads if they happen to be near a job site when I'm in my lunch hour. Then after work gets out, I go out and meet motivated sellers. I wouldn't come home till like 8:30. It was just a really intense like three years there where I didn't know how I would do it, but I wanted to make sure I figured it out and just grinded it out.
But I mean, that's what you have to do, because I mean, if you quit your job too early, you're up a creek without a paddle. So I'm assuming during those 3 years, you're building up your knowledge base, you're building up your systems and processes, you're getting everything dialed in, you're probably building up capital and reserves and all that good stuff, right?
Yes.
So what, I'm always curious, I have to give specific numbers, but what made you feel comfortable? Like, what was going on? Just, were you looking for a certain number of deals, or are you looking for like a certain amount of money's, you know, month's worth of living expenses in the bank? Like, what allowed you to say, great, I'm quitting my job doing this full time? What was this final dominoes that allowed you to do that?
Well, first it was, if I have 6 months of living expenses in the bank, then I'm going to quit.
Okay.
But then I got there and was terrified to quit and didn't. So it turned out that didn't really do it. Because my new problem when I got there, I had 6 months of living expenses in the bank, but it took me like a year and a half to get it. And I was only flipping one house at a time because I didn't have the down payment money to do more than one house at a time.
How are you financing your flips?
Back then, it was Merchants Mortgage.
Okay. They're a local hard money lender. And we've actually had Kim Hubbard of Merchants on this podcast many, many episodes ago.
She's who I worked with.
Oh, yeah. What a small world.
Yeah, definitely.
So you were doing like, were they still doing like the 10% down type loans?
Yep. It was 10%. And I think it started off at 2.5 points and then went down to 2 points.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So that was, I also worked with North Valley Bank for a little bit there too. But between the two of them, that's how I was funding my deals.
Cool. Okay. So you're doing that and then keep going with your stories. I'm always interested in this transition piece. It fascinates me in people's like journey.
Right. So I can look at the numbers and tell that there's no way if I quit my job that I'm going to pay the bills, because I'd only make like a home run job, I'd make 30 grand on, but some of them like 15 grand. because in the Denver market, you're not buying, most people anyway are not flipping houses and making like 50 grand a house. You're making anywhere from 15 to 30 grand a deal. And I could only do one deal at a time. And if it took me a couple months to find the deal, and then I got a couple more months for rehab, and you find your buyer and they close, it was two deals a year. And so if you do the math on that,
it's not much to live off of.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. And I knew it wouldn't work. And so I spent there was that problem, the how can I do more deals because I can't afford to fund them. And then my second problem, drawing a blank here. Oh, market risk. Because even 2 years ago, I was afraid we're going to have another correction like 07. And even if it's not that bad, if it's close to it, I'm tanked.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle. So I had to fix those two problems. And that's what led me to figure out the fix and list deal. That's where my mind was at. I have to figure out how to fix my funding problem and my risk problem. And I fixed both of those problems with the fix and list deal structure.
So this idea just kind of, you've been grinding away thinking, and that just popped in your mind after months or years of...
It was probably over the course of a month of talking with my dad on the phone while driving home from work, just brainstorming like how maybe I could put this together.
Yeah.
And the two of us figured this out, this deal structure.
And what you have now, basically those three options you presented us with the fix and list, similar to the original brainchild you had a couple years ago, or has it evolved since then?
It's definitely evolved since then. My brainchild was I was just going to do the fix and list deals, but now as things have evolved, I'm in a position where I can do multiple flips at a time, and I can handle more. I have the systems and structures in place that I can flip a lot of houses at the same time, and I have the capital to get the funding. I have better funding because I have a better history.
Yeah.
So now I have private money, which helps. But no, my thought was I would just do fix and list deals back when I first thought of it.
Oh, okay. And so you had this idea. Did you immediately quit your job or did you start implementing it? Like, again, we're getting closer.
We're getting closer. So I have this idea and now I'm thinking, well, I'm just going to implement this idea. And after I've replaced I have 6 months where I'm making just as much money in my side business as I'm making in my day job, then I'm going to quit.
Okay.
That makes sense. And I did that pretty quickly after figuring that out.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So did you actually pull the trigger then, or were you still a little risk adverse?
No, I pulled the trigger then.
Now, what about, you mentioned you had two obstacles. One was, the finding the deals or getting more deals in the pipeline. Second one was market risk. How did you solve that solution? Because I don't see a magic wand over there for changing the market.
Yeah, I don't share in the equity on the fix and list deals. The homeowner is going to make, when it closes, whatever that back-end sales price is, regardless of what the market does and how low it goes.
Yep.
Minus the rehab budget, minus the commissions. So whether it sells for what we projected or it doesn't, our profit's almost exactly the same.
Oh, that makes sense. So that's how you mitigate the market risk there.
Yeah.
Okay, that is brilliant. So, something else we talked about when we had coffee a few weeks ago, Eric, was kind of the different, I guess, the different hats one has to wear, when you're doing, basically fix and flips. From deal sourcing to, working with the potential deals to fixing it to listing. And you had kind of a couple buckets or a couple hats you've worn. I know you got it very systematized. So walk us through out there, because I talk to a lot of people out there that want to get into, fix and flips. And again, I am not a fix and flipper. I've done my one fix and flip, and that's enough for me in my career. But I also be like, look, there's a lot of hats you have to wear. Like it's like multiple full-time jobs. I'm always impressed with people that figure out how to do it, because just marketing, just getting those leads coming in, that is a hard thing to do. And then being able to get the skill set to then walk through the house and be like, oh yeah, well, let me walk through, look at this, I'll offer you this much. Like, because I was like, oh, I could probably figure out the deals on my own or the leads. Once I walk through a house, man, I would have no clue how to estimate what the rehab would be. And then this whole process. So just explain people what it really takes, and try to do the best you can to kind of share the knowledge and how much man hours and money it takes as we go through these different phases. And I may have butchered the process, so please set the record straight.
No problem. I think there's three main hats, or at least that's how I look at it. There's the sales hat, which is mainly the role of a real estate agent. That's where it involves closing the deal, like meeting with the lead and closing the deal.
And this is on the front end buy side?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. But also there's the back end side of selling the house, and it's still the sales hat in my point of view. Then there's the construction hat, where you have to be able to both estimate what the rehab's going to be and then manage that rehab. I don't do any of the work myself, and I would really suggest that nobody try to do the work themselves, because it's hard enough just to be the contractor, the realtor, and the lead generator or marketer, that if you tried to actually swing a hammer and keep all those other parts moving, I think it's impossible. So managing the work is the construction hat.
Okay.
And then being the marketer, being able to set up the ads and tweak them and make sure that your cost per lead stays where it needs to be so that you're profitable.
So I've got like 20 questions for each one of those hats. Where do you want to start, Eric?
Oh, I guess just shoot away.
So I'm going to save the marketing for last, just because I tend to geek out on that. I want to hit the other two here. So let's talk about the construction hat, because this was the biggest wild card to me when I did my one fix and flip. That was like my personal testing. This was 2 or 3 years ago. I was testing, say, hey, is the fix and flip model a viable way for me to generate cash and build a real estate business to fund investing? And I realized, hey, I'm going to live and die by GCs or subcontractors that I work with. And hey, I swung a hammer for a GC during, you know, high school jobs and college jobs, which I don't know if that was probably more to my detriment, because it made me want to go in there and do some stuff, which I do. My work takes 10 times the amount of a real professional. So talk to me about the construction hat. Like, what? How do you manage that? How do you find people? Just all that stuff.
I have a huge advantage in that realm, and that I have a carpenter working for me that I genuinely believe is the best carpenter in the whole Denver area. I've known him for over 10 years. He worked for Pinker Construction as a carpenter, and I would try to get him on every job that I would go to. So he was kind of my right-hand man as far as carpentry goes. And when I quit and went off on my own shortly afterwards, he also quit and was calling me and asking if I had work for him. And I have kept him busy full time ever since. So I have that huge advantage.
So relationships led to that one.
Yep.
Okay.
But if I didn't have that, if I wasn't a superintendent and wasn't around construction guys for 10 years before quitting and going off on my own, I think what I would do is try to network on bigger pockets with other investors and try to get referrals of other contractors, and then reach out to those contractors and try to take them out to lunch, try to anything you can do to form a friendship with a contractor, be it a carpenter or a tile setter or electrician, mechanical guys. It's largely relationships, the whole construction management process.
Now, how did you, because you said you had this, you know, carpenter relationship from your previous work history, how did you find the other, you know, subs? How'd you find those guys?
So I have at this point two key carpenters that do tile work, that do drywall, that do painting, that can set cabinets. So they're carpenter, tile setters, painters, drywallers.
So they do a good chunk of it then.
So there's always a key guy I put on each job, and I give him a big portion of the cosmetic work inside of the property. And then you just, all you need to help support that guy is a licensed electrician to do the electric work, and a mechanical guy to switch out water heaters and furnaces, and a plumber to rerun plumbing lines.
Okay.
So really, if you can get the three support guys and then a handful, one or two good carpenters that can do other finish work, you're good to go.
So your carpenters, they're doing anything from framing to the finishing work?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to repeat this. This is very interesting. So you get the key, and you think the carpenter is the key that can kind of do the whole, from the rough framing in, so swinging a hammer to put 2x4s up, to then finishing work, which is setting crown molding.
Right.
Now, is that, I know a lot of times carpenters kind of do one or the other from my limited experience. Is it hard to find people that can do both ends of the spectrum, or is that pretty typical for carpenters to do both of those?
I think there's plenty of guys out there that can do both.
Okay.
But I think that those guys are not looking for work. They are very busy, and someone else is keeping them busy, because when you find that guy, you're never going to let that guy go.
Yes.
So finding him is hard, but they are out there, and it's worth the effort to try to find them. But in the meantime, if you have to hire a tile guy and a carpenter and a drywaller, that works just fine too. It's just a lot more coordination. You know, instead of walking the job with one guy to go over all the finish work and explain what you want, you've got to meet with three or four guys, and it's a lot more time intensive.
So even though your carpenter's doing majority of the work, you're still acting as a GC on the project, or is in essence he's acting as a GC?
Well, like, for instance, in the job that we're finishing up right now in Littleton, I have Jamie is my head carpenter, and he's definitely not the GC. He's setting tiles. He's managing himself, right?
Okay.
So he's not managing anybody else. And then I've got Jorge, who's my electrician, and I meet him, line him out separate. My contract's directly with him. He knows the work he's doing. I have a separate carpenter, kind of jack of all trades carpenter guy that I brought in to finish out the basement, because this was a little bigger job and one guy couldn't get it done on schedule. So I gave the basement to another guy. So I'm managing him. And then I've got the mechanical guy that's switching out a furnace.
Okay. And then, yeah, I mean, you got your key construction guys on your team there. And then what's look like you from the management aspect? Are you there every single day? Are you picking supplies up at Home Depot and dropping them off? Like, how active are you in managing and supporting the rehab?
So I stop by every property at least once a week, most of the time twice a week. And as far as the Home Depot stop goes, I think it really helps everybody involved if you think through the whole job right up front and you make a long list. Like, I need this many square feet of tile, this many toilets, this many vanities. You make your list of all the materials that have any kind of design aspect to them that you wouldn't want a carpenter to go out and buy. They're not commodity materials. You don't have to buy all the sheets of drywall, but all the finish type materials, and get it in one shot and fill up the garage or the living room. Get all the materials, get it all to the house. Otherwise, your life will be a nightmare of constant trips to Home Depot with your carpenter saying, I need this or I need this.
Yeah.
But if you think through it up front, it's not bad at all.
And I'm assuming you have a very detailed checklist for all that stuff, right?
Well, at this point, it's just I walk through the house and make a list on my phone.
You're just that good. You can just walk through and be like, yeah, duh, 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 duh. Wow.
Yeah, just walk through each room and think through what it needs, make the list.
Okay.
There's no formal checklist, but
that's impressive. Okay. So you do that. I'm assuming, like, I'm just using Home Depot as a reference. Do you actually buy the stuff at Home Depot, or do you go to like different shops, or do you just keep it simple and go to the big box store?
Well, it depends on what the material is. So a lot of the stuff I'll go get from Home Depot, but if it's cabinets, I have a vendor I buy all the cabinets from, and they're all the flooring, so carpet or tile. There's a new vendor I have, or another vendor I have for that. Like, I just send an email to the person, because we've done so many deals together and standardized the finished materials. So it's always the same carpet. It's the same tile.
Yeah.
Just send an email. I need this many square feet of this stuff. And then everything else, like the toilets, the vanities, the lights, faucets, all that, I go to Home Depot.
Okay. Great. Yeah. So before we move on to talking about the two other hats we discussed a few minutes ago, I know a lot of people are probably thinking, hey, I want to call Eric to come do a GC or be a GC on my properties. Are you a GC for other people, or are you solely for your projects?
So there was a point where I was a GC for other people, only because things were slower and I was just getting started still, and I needed to keep my crews busy. But at this point, that's never a problem. I have enough fix and list deals and things going that I can easily keep my crews busy. I am trying to expand my crews. So there will be times here and there where I'll take a job on as a GC. Just as I grow my crews, if there's a lull in work, then I'll take on GC projects. But I'm not actively looking for them. And try to avoid them.
Okay.
For the most part.
Good. So if you're listening out there, do not start calling up Eric, asking for bids on a project coming up because he's busy on his own projects.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So let's talk about the hat number one, the sales hat. So again, talking sales hat, construction hat, marketing hat. So sales hat. Talk about that. So you get the marketing hat gets the phone to ring or gets the person to opt in on the website. At that point, that's like kind of where in my mind, I go from marketing to then sales. So you got the potential, homeowner that's motivated to sell. And generally, are they calling you guys? They opt in the website, or is it just all the above? They kind of reach you whatever way.
It's all the above.
Okay.
But I have systems in place where no matter which way they come in, they get put into a CRM. And the CRM assigns it to one of two different real estate agents. And that agent calls the lead, preferably in the first 5 minutes, and tries to set up an appointment to go see the house and close the deal.
So say that again, preferably in the first 5 minutes.
Yes.
Yep. Why is that important?
Because after 5 minutes, the lead is way less likely to convert than if you call them immediately. Because if they've just looked at my website, and they think they want to work with me and they call, or they call and leave the information, no one calls them back, or they fill out the form on the website and no one calls them within the first 5 minutes, they're probably already back at Google searching, looking at another website. And now I've got competitors to deal with.
And now you're a commodity because you're one of four investors calling.
In their mind, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not actually, because I have something better to offer them than all those competitors.
Yes.
But they don't know that until we've met them at the house and started to go over that.
So is that really, because that's something I'm always curious about, because, it always comes and you got a very, unique proposition that you're able to provide people. It can be that uniqueness, it's great, but it can be a double-edged sword sometimes, because you try to explain it too much early on in the marketing funnel, it's confusing, and then people go elsewhere. So
exactly.
Does that message really get driven home? Is that more on the marketing side or more on the sales side as you talk and meet with people, when that's really shown how you're different than a lot of other investors out there?
Just on the sales side.
Really?
I've tried so many times to market the fix and list deal, and it never works. It's too complicated, and every angle, maybe someday, I haven't given up on it. I keep trying. You're right. Maybe someday I'll figure it out. But as weird as it is, though, we'll buy your house fast for cash converts way better than we'll put our money into your house and fix it up and sell it so you can get the most money.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that, because that's very interesting. Great. So you have the expectations. The leads come in. Ideally, they're calling the first 5 minutes. What do you mind saying what CRM you use? I always love knowing the tech people are using.
I use Follow Up Boss.
Follow Up Boss. Okay. I've heard of them. I haven't looked at myself. Follow Up Boss. I'll have to check that out. Okay. So one of your two agents calls them. Are they just given like round robin style, or are you manually in there saying, I'll give this lead to this person?
Well, one of the good and bad things to Follow Up Boss is it's a very simple software. There's not a lot of options to it. And so I have it on round robin, but in order to manipulate the leads the way that I want them to, I'll have to manually go in and take people out of round robin for a while and then put them back in to get them dispersed the way that I want.
So how does that interferes with that 5 minute initial call window, right?
It doesn't, because the lead instantaneously gets texted to whoever it was assigned to.
Okay.
So if I want one of the agents to get less leads, I just take them out of the round robin sequence for a while.
Oh, so you're actually talking about removing the agent out of the round robin versus in there manually transferring the leads.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't manually transfer the leads.
Okay, no. That makes sense. And just so you guys, I realize we're using the term round robin. It basically means as leads come in, first one goes to person A, second one to person B, third one to person C, and around and around and around as we go. So that's what that phrase means. Okay, so you do that. They go into Follow Up Boss, ideally a 5 minute window. And is it phone call, meeting? What's the sales process?
Phone call, meeting.
Yeah. So you get on the phone to sell the meeting, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And also to qualify the lead. So if the person seems like they're completely an asshole and we would never want to work with them.
Yeah. Yes.
It's phone call dead.
But is there more qualification? I'm assuming, are you asking questions like, you know, when did you own the house? How much equity do you have? Like, are you kind of asking qualifications on the property, or is it more just qualifying to make sure like, hey, great, this person's a total jerk?
So the way that I handle the leads that I'm calling back, I'm not asking about how much equity they have in the house. I feel like most people, every once in a while, that's a deal killer, but I don't want to plant the seed of doubt that the person may be getting taken advantage of with the lead. And so I think it's all about trust, because their guard's way up. They called someone about selling their house fast for cash. They already think that you're going to try to screw them. They know they're in a bad situation. So anything I can do to help them feel comfortable, like, we're going to do everything we can to help give you all the options we can to get you out of your situation. And I don't go into, well, how much equity do you have and what do you owe on your house? I leave that till the end. And sometimes it'll kill a deal. But I think it would hurt me more if I put that on the front end.
Interesting, because I mean, from my very limited experience in doing a little bit of lead gen and looking at, you know, motivated sellers, those are the questions that is typically they say you should always ask. And you're not asking those.
I'm not.
Okay. Now,
and I can't speak directly for both of the agents that I give leads to.
Yeah.
Some of, you know, they might be. I don't know what those call.
So
I can't
you don't have
them,
like a script of like, hey, here are the 6 questions you have to ask?
No.
Wow. Okay.
So I have 2 different agents working with me. One's a newer agent and the other one's very seasoned. With the newer agent, I went through everything I do and gave that to them. And then he can tweak it as he feels necessary to close the most deals.
Okay. And then do you know like the rough ratio, like if you know, 10 leads come in, they're assigned to me, one of your agents, out of those 10 leads, how many am I going to meet with and how many actually turn into a deal under one of those 3 options?
So it's very seasonal. It can swing a lot one way or the other. But over the course of the whole year, we look at the last 10 months, it's about 10 leads to every 1 deal.
Okay. Great. So that's so about a 10% close ratio based off leads you're generating.
Yeah.
And that's good.
I had a 25% close rate when I was taking all the leads and I went on all the calls myself. It was a lot higher. Because I wore all the hats. So they were talking to the contractor. They were talking to, and I was really hungry to close every deal instead of just work with the people that we want to work with.
Yeah. And then, I mean, that's typical. If you're doing everything, you'll usually get the best results. But the problem is you're a one-man band and that's not scalable.
Exactly.
I'm assuming you probably have a much better work-life balance now too, right?
It's so much better.
Yeah. Cool. So I want to move to the third side, which is the marketing side. Because that's obviously my background, what really interests me and what we talked about for hours, weeks ago on. And in my mind, that's probably the most important, because if you can't market and generate leads, the other 2 hats really don't matter. It is my linear thinking, but of course I'm a marketer. So a lot of times that's how I see things. So talk to people about what you take to go out there and generate leads. Don't give away the secret sauce, because I talk to people all the time in person on, you know, like Bigger Pockets forums where people are talking about, oh, I want to go mail out like 100 postcards to get some leads. And I'm like, yeah, don't even waste your time. But I've not done it. That's just my general marketing sense. But what does it take and what do you do?
Yeah, so this evolves constantly. I'm always trying new things and there's always the new better thing.
Oh, yeah.
But in general, right now, big picture, I think the best strategy for today's market is to use Google AdWords to get the most qualified leads, and then pair that with Facebook and their lookalike audiences, their artificial intelligence, to find people that look like the expensive leads that you bought off of Google AdWords and get more leads from Facebook. So essentially, I run Google AdWords ads. People click on those ads. It's really expensive. They go to my website. They get pixeled with the Facebook pixel. So now Facebook knows they were there. And then Facebook is constantly updating a lookalike audience, people that are similar to the people that Google sent. And then I market on Facebook for much less money per lead and use their artificial intelligence.
I totally believe it makes sense. So to kind of paint people that picture, so you got a potential homeowner out there. They're on Google search, and they're typing in whatever, I need to sell my home in Denver cash, whatever keywords you have, and a couple ads pop up along with the results. And on those keywords, those ads, you pay per click when someone clicks on them, and they are usually not cheap clicks.
No, they're not.
Like, really not cheap clicks. So people click on that, and then is your goal to generate the lead off of Google or just to get the pixel data on the Facebook?
To generate the lead.
To generate the lead. Okay, so you're going for, great, if 10 people click, we get this many opt-in, we get the lead. And then the Facebook pixel is a thing that allows Facebook to track you. So it's like when you go to HomeDepot.com, look at a lawnmower, and then you see that damn lawnmower everywhere for the next 7 days. That's yep. The pixel right there working. So do you pixel people on the landing page, or do you only pixel and create the lookalike audience after they've converted?
On the landing page.
Yeah, okay.
Right, and I'll retarget to those people on the Google Ads display network. So everywhere they go, every website all over the place is my ad on the sidebar after they've seen my landing page, but then they also are getting followed on Facebook.
So you're getting them everywhere. Because I mean, between Facebook network and Google Display network, that's
everywhere.
That's pretty much everything.
Right. And the one thing I haven't tried yet, and it's my next thing on my to-do list, is figure out how to integrate YouTube ads into all this.
Oh, yes. That's on my list, too. cool. So, I mean, that's a very high-level overview. That's like the big picture. So as far as people wanting to, you know, go out there and generate leads, what advice can you give people that want to go out there and become a wholesaler, become a fix and flipper? Like, what's the time and money commitment to even make it worthwhile to dip your toe into the marketing world? Is that something you try for a week?
No, it's not. So that's the hardest part about it, because you might sink 15 grand into ads before you have anything to show for it. You know, for instance, let's say you set an ad budget of you're going to spend $5,000 a month, and you do that for 3 months. Even if you hit a home run, those deals still need to close and you need to make your profit before you have any money left to go continue advertising. So I think if you should have probably $15,000 in the bank that you can lose, that you're willing to sink in, and you're not going to lose your house if you have no return on it.
Yeah. So let's talk about this, because, you got to have the marketing ad spend, and then usually, even with most hard money loans, you got to have certain reserves, or you got to throw cash in there for, you know, to fund the rehab. Like, what's some basic numbers? If I came to you and said, hey, Eric, I want to get into fix and flipping, what would you recommend, some rough numbers for me to be able to commit, and like a rough time frame?
I would recommend that you have $15,000 in the bank. Because after you get a deal, you can always use loans to fund that deal. And that's much less risky than you don't want to borrow money and use it on advertising. Because if it doesn't work, you are screwed. You've got no collateral to back up that loan.
So don't put it on a credit card.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you had 15 grand, you're good. Because after that, as you get deals, it's a lot easier to get money to do deals. Like, for instance, you can go to Lightstream right now and get an auto loan that's unsecured for over 50 grand. And because it's unsecured, they don't even see if you buy a car with that. And you can have the money in 72 hours. You don't even need a hard money lender. And you pay 5% and just bam, there. Now you have 50 grand to go renovate a house for a fix and list deal.
And this is off just a car I own and go get a...
You know, a car actually has nothing to do with it. They just call it a car loan, but it's unsecured.
Oh my gosh.
So there's money is easy to get right now.
Yeah.
I think as long as your credit's good, it's going to be no problem to get the cash, but you just want to be smart to not get the cash for something that's not collateralized on your end. You know, if you're getting a loan and you're putting it in someone's house, you have a note and deed on that house to cover your investment. It's a lot less risky than putting it into advertising. So about 15 grand. And then I would say you need to be all in for at least 6 months. Like if you took that 15 grand and you spent 5 grand a month for 3 months, you're probably going to run out of money before you have any more money coming in. But hopefully you have a deal coming in. You can just turn your ads off, wait till the money comes back in, and then shovel it back in and keep going.
But you said 6 months. So do you recommend, so if I had that 15 grand, I mean, what, that's about a little less than 3 grand a month? Or am I doing that?
Yeah. I'm saying that you need 6 months, don't be quitting your job because you're not going to see any income for probably six months, even if you knock it out of the park.
Okay. That makes sense. Okay. And so then, I mean, as you were, I mean, because I understand everything you're doing marketing wise from like the big picture point of view, but in there actually learning that stuff, I mean, it's a learning curve. And then are you still there doing ads yourself? Are you hiring people? Like, what's the right balance for people when I learn? Like, how much are they doing the air quotes sweat equity themselves versus, hey, I should hire an ad agency instead of run ads?
So I've done both. I hired an ad agency and I've ran a lot of ads myself. And I'm convinced that I think it never makes sense to hire an ad agency. I think you should do all of your advertising yourself. That is the last thing you would ever farm out. I think you'd want to partner with a contractor and a real estate agent and keep the marketing hat till the very, very end.
And make that the last thing you outsource.
The very last thing that you outsource.
Why?
So for instance, with Google AdWords, it costs, even if you get a really good deal, about $900 a month just paying the person to run your ads. And if you're spending, you know, even say $3,000 a month, which you probably should be at least at $3,000 a month to have any kind of impact.
A third of your budget then.
Yeah. Your cost per lead just skyrocketed.
Yeah.
Because of paying them. Like, you could do it yourself and really suck at it and still come out better than paying the ad agency. That's what I found. As soon as I fired the ad agency, even though I didn't know what I was doing very well yet, I still had better numbers, like right off the bat on day one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very much a similar wavelength too, because I mean, my attitude when I was learning marketing, I mean, years ago, this is like when Google AdWords first came out, was to, rather than buying these expensive courses or hiring people, because back then it was all just courses. There were no ad agencies. It was all courses. I'd say, you know what? Rather than me spending $1,000 on a course or $5,000 in a seminar, I'm going to rather spend that money on ads and let that be my tuition, so to speak. But I actually go in there and read the Google Ads manual. And then years later, I read the Facebook Ads manual. So I'm definitely on the same wavelength as you. It's like, hey, you should be doing the ads yourself because that is the hardest thing to outsource and manage and keep that quality control. And before you go out there and hire people, spend a bunch of money, guys, actually go read that respective ad platform's own advertising guideline, because I've talked to some people like, oh yeah, I just spent $1,000 on this, you know, whatever. The latest Google, or now it's all Facebook, the latest Facebook ads budget. I'm like, oh, cool. How much was it? Oh, it was $1,000. Cool. So have you actually read the Facebook ad manual? No. I would start there before I spend money. what would you tell people when they learn, like, where should they start, like, specifically? Did you just Google stuff, trial and error, buy courses, what?
So I'm in a different camp when it comes to buying courses. I've bought a lot of courses and feel like I've learned a lot from the courses that I've bought. AdWords Nerds is pretty popular. A lot of investors have heard of them. I bought the very first, they haven't been doing courses for that long, but about a year ago, like, I bought a course from AdWords Nerds and I learned a lot about Google AdWords from that. And so I think buying a good course is smarter than paying. If the course costs 1 month's worth of management fees, it makes more sense to buy the course, absorb the knowledge, and then put it to work every month.
Yes.
They're moving forward.
100% agree. Okay. So I want to ask this question. We're hitting the hour mark, so we'll start wrapping things up. So this is my favorite question to ask people. If you could go back in time, at your time machine, hopped in your DeLorean, hop back 10, 15 years ago, whatever, and you could have the wisdom and knowledge you have now, what would you go back and tell your younger, inexperienced self to help that journey along the way?
I would tell myself to forget about every business I ever even had an inkling of starting that wasn't related to real estate. To, instead of chasing whatever looks like the next easy money thing that you could start as a business, to just focus on real estate and solely real estate. Because the hardest money you possibly can make is chasing the easy money.
That's good advice. So something else, and I know this is something that we talked, and hopefully you don't mind me mentioning this, but I know you're starting to put together a program or course, or I'm not quite sure the correct terminology, but actually you've talked about putting together a program and teach people how to do the fix and list process, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so that is something that will be out sometime this year.
So I've
give us the 60-second rundown on this.
Yeah, I just finished the first run through creating that course. So it's done in its original form right now. And it's available at selfmadeflipper.com/lesson. And it's brand new for me, though. It's something that I think I would really enjoy helping other people go through that same transformation that I did and use this to quit their day job so they can flip houses full time. I also think this business model is a huge win-win for everyone involved. So the more people doing it in more markets, the better off everyone will be. The people that get to quit their job and do the business, and all their customers that are stuck in a situation where they need to get the equity out of their house, but they don't have the cash to maximize that return. So
great. So, I mean, I could talk to you for hours longer, Eric. So we'll definitely have you back on to talk more marketing and talk more flipping. But if people want to reach you or learn more about it, is it best to go to that website or reach out to you directly? How do you want to kind of put it out there so people can reach out to you, but not to hire you as a GC?
Yeah. So I guess people could feel free to email me at, and I have two businesses right now. You could email me at eric@denverpropertyflip.com, or I also have the email eric@selfmadeflipper.com, which is, you know, in its infant stages.
Yeah, and they'll both get to you, right?
Both of them go to the same spot.
Cool. I'll put those in the show notes. Cool. Well, Eric, thank you so much, man. This has been fun. I learned some stuff. I think our listeners did as well, so thank you.
No, thanks for having me on.